The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, game is gone. Here's what we got in its place. Leeds call them Brace Dallas Powered as they beat Man City. West Ham also having problems with Leeds as they almost blow another 3-goal one. At Spurs, Edinson does what it says on the tin in a 3-1 win for Man United, while Fulham's lack of finish means they probably are after Newcastle's win at Burnley. We've got all of that coming up, plus a couple of thoughts about midweek and the Intertotally and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. Thank you so much for joining us. It may well be Monday the 12th of April for you, but it's very much Sunday evening for us as we record this Totally Football Show featuring the mighty thoughts of Daniel Storey. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, James.
Also, Michael Cox with us.
Hi, James.
And getting in on the act, it's Adam Hurry. All right, Adam.
Hello, James. Yes, all right. Thank you.
AKA football cliches. Very nice. Let's see, complaints about VAR, Mourinho deflection nonsense, a ponder over whether Ollie's actually quite good. If you've got those on your Totally Bingo card, stand by for an early house today because there's been a lot of our favourite storylines re-emerging with a vengeance. In what was a very entertaining weekend, would you say?
I liked a lot of goals in every game. It was one of those where I was looking at the fixture list of the 8 games and it felt like all of them were either exciting or meaningful. Which at this stage of the season is not always the case. So, yeah, I very much enjoyed the weekend.
All right, then. Gets the zonal marking thumbs up. Let's check out the scores. Of course, Saturday saw leaders at Man City beaten by Leeds with only 10 men. Man City now 11 points ahead of Man United, who did Spurs 3-1 on Sunday afternoon. Behind them, it's all go in the top four race. West Ham's 3-2 win over Leicester. Chelsea beating Palace 4-1 and Liverpool beating Villa 2-1 means that Leicester are now only 1 point above the Hammers and one of four teams with Chelsea and Liverpool within just 4 points of each other. All those sides battling for two Champions League places. Down the bottom end, Newcastle now 6 points clear of Fulham with a game in hand after their 2-1 win at Burnley and Fulham's Friday night defeat to Wolves. Crikey. West Brom play Monday against Saints and there's Brighton Everton later on in the evening as well. I vote we start with David Moyes' Band of Brothers, whose campaign to make 3-0 a dangerous scoreline continued on Sunday in an electric clash with Leicester.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
So foul, keeping West Ham on the front foot, and Jesse Lingard! He's only here on loan. He may only be passing through, but they won't forget him if his goals fire them into Europe.
West Ham 3, Leicester 2. Third game in a row in which West Ham have gone 3-0 up. Arsenal pulled it back to 3-3. Wolves got it back to 3-2. Leicester very nearly did that. Huge chance for Wesley Fofana at the end. One or two questions there. David Moyes looking furious through much of the final 20 minutes. But it would, I think most Hammers fans feel, be churlish to complain about this team as they roar back into the top four. How impressed, Daniel, were you with West Ham?
Yeah, kind of. They played pretty much the same way, but that's significant because they were missing most of the spine of the team. Ogbonna was out, Declan Rice obviously out, and Mikel Antonio's now out as well. And Rice and Antonio in particular felt like they didn't really have the players to replace them. Mark Noble's played more advanced as a midfielder at the end of last season, but he kind of slotted in and did the sitting job. And yeah, Jared Bowen played centrally, and yet Jesse Lingard continues to be the informed player in the league. I think I'm right in saying since he joined West Ham, he's a top goal scorer in the league. He's had the most shots on target and he's got the second most assists behind Mikel Antonio, which is, people are sort of saying, oh, it shows that Lingard was just a good footballer anyway, and we should have known that, and which is completely valid. But I think we're allowed to be surprised that it's gone this well, this quickly at a new club, because he doesn't just look like he's enjoying his football. He looks like the informed midfielder in the Premier League, which he's never been before.
Mm. Is he the difference? Is he the reason that West Ham are top four and genuinely looking like they could be in the Champions League next season?
I don't know if he's the reason that they are, or that they are the reason he's settled in so quickly, because Moyes seems to have this emphatic team spirit that doesn't seem to matter who comes in and out of the team. They all pretty much play the same way.
All right. A lot of players coming out as well as going in at the moment. You mentioned those already absent, and Noble, who'd slotted in for Rice, slotting out again with what looked like a pretty serious injury to his right arm. Didn't look good anyway. Cresswell also going out in that game. But Jesse Lingard with another brace. That first goal, Adam.
I know. I mean, West Ham are in this enviable position, it seems, that they've got two that men. They've got that man, Jesse Lingard, who in tandem with that man, Thomas Suchek, is an incredibly strong position to be in. I can't think of a previous Premier League club who have had two such unexpected that men. But it was really nice. I mean, the commentary kind of praised the cutback for his first goal as quite a nice pass. It wasn't at all. It was sort of this bouncing ball that he had to deal with. And quite an orthodox finish. He kind of sort of swept it in very knowingly. And it was actually quite a deliberate finish. And you don't see a finish quite like that anymore. He sort of swept it in with the top of his boot. And I mean, it's not often that I would romanticise like this, but I do like seeing a player who is quite clearly a decent bloke enjoying his football at a club who appreciates him.
Yeah, absolutely. He was speaking as well about his mother's battle with depression on social media this week. Which obviously is social media, big topic of late. But yeah, it was really interesting to hear him speaking so kind of openly about that. And I think can only make us warm to him even more. So West Ham looking fabulous. Michael, do you want to say nice things about West Ham or move straight on to the Leicester is it happening again question?
I think all the nice things that need to be said have been said.
All right, then hit Leicester hard. Go for it.
Well, they did look like a side who had, you know, lost a couple of players in surprise circumstances, and maybe the rest of the squad were feeling a little bit uneasy about that. Seems like this house party didn't just involve Maddison and Perez, but a couple of other players who, you know, are out through injury at the moment or not involved with the squad. So it was clearly something, I don't know, just get the impression it was a little bit like when, you know, when you're at school and a couple of kids got into trouble and everyone kind of knew about it or felt like they were vaguely involved in some way. I don't know. They just looked so flat throughout the first half.
Right.
And it was almost like they knew that West Ham had this reputation for going 3-0 up and then just collapsing, because they did keep plugging away. And Iheanacho, who's been their best player in the last couple of months, obviously scored a couple of very decent goals. But yeah, I mean, I sometimes I'm reluctant to attribute the result of a game to the news story of the day. But it feels like this was a case where the two went hand in hand. There was clearly a big issue at Leicester. And I think Leicester put out a statement about it midway through the game, which I found unusual. But they were clearly quick to get their explanations in.
So Maddison, Perez and Choudhury, the three players dropped for breaching COVID-19 protocols. But for the gossipy among you, can anyone provide more details on, you know, more salacious details on what actually that involved?
I don't think it was particularly salacious. It was just that they went to a house party, whether they organised it or not. But the fact that there were three, and it sounds like maybe two other Leicester players there as well, suggests that they were the focus of it, which, like, without getting too high and mighty morally, it's just a really dim thing to do. Partly because you're obviously going to get found out. And secondly, even if you don't get found out, if one of you, low chance, but if one of you catches coronavirus at the party and then it isn't found out before you return to training and stuff, that could have been catastrophic for Leicester season. So, I mean, if I was Brendan Rodgers, I'd be absolutely genuinely furious, because in a kind of run-in when everybody knows you collapsed from kind of this stage onwards last season, just such a dim thing to do.
Personally, as someone who perhaps fears social rejection perhaps a bit too much, my attention was drawn a little bit more towards the 20 or so Leicester players who weren't invited to the party. Should we ask Casper? No, he's a bit much. But I suspect if they had invited Mark Honest Pro Albrighton, he would have dobbed them in straight away, and that party would never happen. So perhaps they were wise to keep it narrow.
Although, of course, there's nothing funny about people broaching COVID-19 protocols. Right. Leicester, they're only 2 points above fifth place Chelsea now. Crikey. How worried should Brendan Rodgers be?
I think probably quite worried. I looked at Jamie Vardy, who of course previously has been known for having parties, but apparently wasn't involved in this one. He's just going through a really difficult spell at the moment. It was just making runs that didn't really make sense. A couple of times it was miscontrolled. And yeah, it was quite a worrying performance. And I don't know whether there's much in the way of, you know, there's a historical precedent for Rodgers doing this. I'm not sure whether there's any pattern between the seasons, but certainly, you know, Chelsea are hot on their heels. And West Ham, who I must admit, I thought by this stage of the season would be falling out of contention, keep on going, obviously, most obviously with this game. So, yeah, I do slightly worry for them, yeah.
One thing I did enjoy about, the consciousness of West Ham's pattern at the moment of going 3-0 up and nearly throwing it away isn't lost on David Moyes, who said after the game, we've got to get out of the habit of going 3 goals up and then conceding. I've made the players well aware of that. Sometimes management isn't that difficult after all. Yeah, that sounds fairly logical. Thanks.
But the ironic thing about that is, presumably, if before a game you'd said, right, David, I'll give you a 3-goal head start, but then you concede, presumably he would take that.
Yes. So the other thing on Leicester, which is a little bit daunting, is given that they wobbled so much at the end of last season, the last three league games are Man United away, Chelsea away and Spurs at home, which is, if they were going to have a wobble, maybe Brendan Rodgers thinks, get it done now, and then, you know, they've got some reasonably easy games coming up. But you can just see them. You can see Mourinho winning that last day of the season, even if it means Tottenham don't get into the Champions League and kind of nobody being happy as Mourinho and Rodgers stomp around the King Power.
I tell you, I love it when we get to the stage of the season where we're talking about the run-in. That genuinely makes me quite excited. I think about 30 games on the board is where you can, maybe 8 games to go, is where you can legitimately look at the fixtures. And just doing that today, I looked at Fulham's fixtures today and I was like, nah, that's them gone. And it just genuinely feel quite exciting because the relegation battle probably won't be much of a thing, will it? But the Champions League battle, I think, is going to be quite exciting.
Right, indeed. All right then, while Leicester get hammered, some of the players for possibly not the first time this week, let's turn our thoughts to the game that followed them on Sunday. And that was, of course, Spurs-Man United. I joked about 3-0 and dangerous scorelines earlier. Is there a scoreline that isn't dangerous to Spurs?
I mean, yeah, it was, you know, you said at the top of the show about this was kind of weekend that seemed to hammer home stories we've already been talking about, and this was exactly that. Manchester United coming from behind away from home, I think for the 8th time this season, to win. Their away record is phenomenal. They can take 45 points away from home this season, and the Premier League record is 50 by Manchester City. And yeah, Tottenham's inability to hold a lead, but more than that, just their kind of deliberate passivity after going a goal up. But I think they had 27% possession between scoring the first goal and conceding the equaliser. And then the weird thing about Mourinho is that obvious, whatever he says, that seems to be a deliberate ploy, and you know, it can work to kind of sit out and defend a lead, but the fact this keeps happening, and yet when they concede the equaliser, there isn't any instant shift through the gears. You know, he waited until I think like 75 minutes, maybe 76 minutes, to bring on Bale. And yet, even then, there isn't really a plan other than we've got more attackers on the pitch now. Let's just go a bit more direct and try and do everything a little bit more quickly. And that isn't really a plan. You know, it's not enough.
We'll come back onto Mourinho and how in a second or two. But, Marky, you were really impressed by Man United's response to going behind, particularly because it wasn't all about counter-attacks and Fernandes.
Yeah, that was my point, James. Thanks for spilling the beans. Yeah, I mean, yeah, usually in big games, they're one of the two things we say. They have been at times very reactive, very good at breaking. Sometimes Fernandes has got them out of jail with a moment of brilliance, but he was actually really quiet, I thought. Aside from one good shot he had with his left foot that Lloris made a good save from, I thought there's probably an argument he was Manchester United's least influential player in this game, and yet they won it through good passing combinations. I think Solskjaer made a bit of a change for the second half with Pogba coming in to play more in a central position rather than on the left. I think that really helped. I thought he was actually very good in the second half, Pogba. And yeah, they just played good football. I mean, even the goal that was disallowed in the first half, which didn't matter in the end, but that was a brilliant move. I thought Pogba's kind of almost holding up of play and waiting for the run was just really, really clever. And yeah, it was just a good all-round performance. I thought one of the best performances from them for a long time. They started slowly, I thought. First 20 minutes, they weren't really in the game. But I thought the scoring pretty much went with the pattern of the game. And yeah, I thought they probably did deserve to win it by 2 goals in the end.
All right, or possibly more. Fred with the equaliser, Cavani with that wonderful diving header, and Greenwood making it safe in stoppage time. And it should have been four, no? Because Cavani's opening, what would have been Cavani's opening goal, which was disallowed because of McTominay's brutal flick in Son's face. I mean, I don't know. One of the many contentious decisions from Stockley Park, where football goes to die, that we suffered through this weekend. And credit to United that they came back from that rank injustice.
Some of the chat before this game was, well, because they're both so counter-attacky this season, that this would be a kind of cancelling each other out session. But I don't really think that's how counter-attack versus counter-attack works. It would end, really, it just naturally ends up with whoever the cleverer, more imaginative team are taking control, because, you know, they're not going to just sort of spend the game counter-attacking each other. It just couldn't work. So I wasn't massively surprised that turned out to be United, even though Fernandes, I agree, wasn't hugely influential. Pogba did sort of step up a bit. That first goal, as Coxie pointed out, was Pogba at his most imaginative. It was very Power League, actually, that goal, sort of slipping someone in and then sort of tucking it away. That's the standard of Power League I play, by the way, just to make it clear. But yeah, very impressed by United. Proving a few people wrong.
Okay. Speaking of proving people wrong, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we go live now to Daniel and his ongoing deep thought experiment in trying to work out if Solskjaer is quite good or not. Any updates, Daniel? Are the jury still out there somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to say the thing I've said probably seven times in a row when I've answered this question, I don't think he's the best manager Manchester United could have. But
do you think he's better than you thought he was a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, definitely. Okay. Not necessarily a couple of weeks ago, but he's certainly better than I thought, or he's done better than I thought he would when he was appointed. Yeah, definitely. Okay. We should say the kind of post-match stuff between Mourinho and Solskjaer, which was absolutely bizarre.
And Itaraldi says, I absolutely need the guy's take on Mourinho, apparently not knowing the difference between figurative and literal speech. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, in reaction to that Son McTominay business that saw a goal disallowed for United, saying, I have to say, if my son stays down for 3 minutes and needs his 10 mates to help him up, he won't get any food, which is a weird thing to say, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is a bit weird anyway. Mourinho replied, Son is very, very lucky that his father is a better person than Ollie. And then he goes on about bread is bread and cheese is cheese.
The amazing thing he says is he kind of he says that and everyone sort of, there's a sort of ripple of this is going to be good stuff. And then he goes deadpan serious and says, I'm a father and you always have to feed your kids. It doesn't matter what they do. It's like, yeah, this isn't a public service information film about parenting, Jose.
He also said that the press didn't have enough moral honesty to ask him about Solskjaer's comments, which, you know, if anyone's an authority, it's Jose.
At which point the glass house just falls to the ground. Yeah.
I mean, I'm all for deflection tactics, and it's one part of Mourinho's enduring armoury that I completely sympathise with. It makes perfect sense that you would want to deflect attention away from the fact that your team are rubbish or momentarily rubbish. But in this example, I genuinely think that he took Solskjaer way too literally. And just went off on one. And I mean, there may be another level of irony going on here, but I don't think so.
You don't think? I think he just saw the opportunity to completely get everyone discussing bread is bread and cheese is cheese and whatnot.
Why is there always a phrase from Portugal that seems to fit very, very loosely with these situations? They have a massive array of sayings over there, it would seem. But bread is bread and cheese is really good.
It says a lot, isn't it? I'm sure we'll all be dropping into our conversation this week. Michael, you wrote about Jose's tactics and how they're actually designed just to make sure everybody else gets the blame but him recently for The Athletic. What did you make of Spurs' approach in this game?
I mean, the thing with Mourinho is it's difficult really to find new stuff to say about him because we've seen this kind of pattern so many times before. But it's even more difficult this season because we've seen the pattern in individual games so many times before. And, you know, the stats show that. Spurs are really good in the first half and then drop really deep. And, you know, to kind of echo what Daniel said, they didn't at all hit back after the equaliser. And I've got a kind of theory that it's quite difficult for teams to make the reverse shift within games, if that makes sense. You go from being very attacking to very defensive, but you can't then go back or the reverse, and that seems to be Tottenham's problem at some stages. But this, yeah, it was really flat, and it was disappointing because, like I said, I thought they started really well, and I thought Mourinho, to me, it looked like they'd tried to target Shaw, who he didn't like at Manchester United, and he was sure was really bad in the reverse fixture. In the 6-1, he was abysmal. And it looked like there was a lot of attempts to kind of move him out of position and get runners in behind. But obviously Shaw had the last laugh at the end. There were quite a funny couple of photos going around of him embracing Solskjaer with Mourinho looking really miserable next to him. So yeah, it was just more of the same from Tottenham and Mourinho. It's a bit disappointing in the end how flat they were, because I thought the first half was a really good game, but United completely dominant after the break.
A lot of people sort of are going to make this kind of a philosophical thing for Mourinho, kind of the familiar failings. But the fact is, this is a genuine game management issue, because he ended up with Højbjerg and Sissoko anchoring his midfield while they were desperately chasing a game. So as Michael correctly points out, when you're going in that other direction, when you're suddenly having to chase a game that you thought was safe, personnel-wise, they just weren't equipped to do it. So if you can't hold on to a lead, you really are screwed.
If Mourinho has nothing else, is the fact that when he goes back to a former club and goes to face a manager like Solskjaer, who I think it was June last year, he kind of said, I really think this guy's out of his depth, basically. That's normally enough for him to be able to energise those players to say, yeah, I really need this one, or we really need this one, but basically I really need this one. So to fall so flat in this type of game makes you kind of think, wonder really what's left.
Well, quite. Next up, let's look at Man City, Liverpool and the Champions League midweek.
At Paddy Power, we know there are plenty of risks in football. Parking the bus at 1-0, signing that promising youngster for 50 million, or predicting Pep's lineups for your fantasy team. But at Paddy Power, we don't want you to take unnecessary risks. So when you sign up for a new account, you'll get your first bet up to £10 risk-free. That's money back as cash if it loses. Paddy Power. New customers only. Deposit using cards or via Apple Pay. First bet on sportsbook markets only. Minimum deposit. Max refund £10. Online exclusive. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
And Leeds are coming, and there's a ball forward for Stuart Dallas, and Dallas is through, and Stuart Dallas has scored for Leeds! Stuart Dallas breaks through the middle and rolls the ball in! The 10 men of Leeds United!
Saturday afternoon, Leeds doing Man City with just 10 men. And Harry, I enjoyed your tweet. You are 1-0 up, but down to 10 men at half-time against Pep Guardiola's side. Sounds like a module on the UEFA Pro licence. Bielsa answered it pretty well.
He did. I mean, I feel like we've seen a similar type of scenario quite a lot at Big Six clubs, where they're chasing the points late on, and the team that who are attempting to counter-attack against them just don't have the guts to finish them off. And sometimes these chances are glaring ones as well, but and to the point where when they're missed, they're weirdly kind of glossed over, because the narrative is that the Big Six club are chasing this game and it doesn't really matter. But for once, a club had the guts to finish these moves off. I mean, in many cases, that Dallas opportunity at the end, I feel like it would have just sort of been scuffed, or he would have taken it earlier or something like that. But Leeds are a very confident team, because they've been drilled to be. And if anyone were going to pull that off, I would have suspected it would be Leeds. But I mean, we're 10 men as well.
Yeah.
Spectacularly.
So they take the lead, which was already a bit of a shock, but then they go down to 10 men. A Liam Cooper red card, which had Leeds fans pretty upset, not least because Fernandinho's tackle on Rafinha later on seemed way more intentional and at least as violent. That's the one where he basically went in on Rafinha and sent him spiralling through the air, and then subsequently leaving the field with an injury. But anyway, they go down to 10 men, then City equalise, and the narrative is now can 10 men Leeds hang on for a point. But no, as you say, Stuart Dallas, with his second of the game, on only the second shot from Leeds of the game, making it 2-1. Man City had 29 shots against Leeds 2. And afterwards we had a classic bit of Bielsa where he says, I didn't beat Pep. It's a game between two teams with the players being the predominant factors. We are just simply the two managers of the teams that face each other. We deserve to win, but the just and fair thing would have been for City to win. So,
I like it. It sounds like he's Googled the question on Wikipedia and just completely read out the page he's found. I really like the answer.
Magnificent.
You know, Bielsa brings a lot in terms of the tactical drilling of the side, but there's also a lot he brings in terms of belief and confidence. It's kind of what Adam alludes to. And I mean, the game plan they played here, they won't have worked on that in training. I can't imagine. It was basically just getting men behind the ball and parking the bus, really. But they got through it because I think there is, you know, there's a fight and there's a determination about them. And that does come from the management. So, yeah, I thought it was a brilliant game for exactly the reason you say, James, in the sense that the 15 minutes after City equalised, it was, there's two outcomes of this game. Is it going to be a draw or Man City win? And then it was the third outcome. It was the outcome that I didn't even really, until Rafinha had that counter-attack where Edison kind of tackled him, I hadn't even considered the idea Leeds might snatch it. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant game. And it was kind of nice afterwards because, I mean, City didn't go for it, did they? I mean, they left Mahrez. Mahrez didn't come off the bench. Mm. De Bruyne didn't come off the bench. They rested players for this. And Guardiola seemed like quite, just seemed to enjoy the fact that football can be so mad sometimes. Because, I mean, 29-2 on shots and you lose 2-1 is, I mean, that is incredible. I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant game. I loved it.
Mm. And no one, he'd rather lose 2-1-2 in those circumstances, I'm sure, than Marcelo Bielsa. A lot of players rested. De Bruyne, Mahrez, Foden and Gundogan, who did come on. Nathan Ake making his first start since Boxing Day. And the reason for that, one imagines, is Borussia Dortmund, who are coming up on Wednesday after a first leg, which also finished 2-1, but to City, but was a lot tighter, I think, than a lot of people expected. This weekend, in contrast to City, Dortmund were winners, 3-2, in fact, away at Stuttgart with Jude Bellingham, who was unfairly treated by the ref last week, getting a goal, his first goal in the Bundesliga. Oh, and that teenager, Ansgar Knauf, the one who made his first ever start for Dortmund in the City game, actually got his first goal for the club at Stuttgart. There you go. What do you think about City's chances?
I think the thing that will, Guardiola will not necessarily mind the result, and he was right to make the changes, but he will be slightly irked by the fact that they are still falling into that trap of creating, not just having a lot of shots, but also creating quite a number of dangerous situations that don't even end in a shot. And you look at their Champions League exits, and they basically follow that pattern. You know, they had 20 shots against Liverpool in 2018, scored once. They had that first leg against Spurs, where I think they only had about 10 or 11 shots, but missed a penalty. That Sterling missed that chance against Lyon, and then Lyon go down the other end and score. And I think that's what will worry him, because they kind of did that to a slightly lesser extent against Dortmund last week as well. So that will annoy him if City fall into that trap, because I think that's the only thing that will stop them getting to the Champions League final if PSG get through against Bayern.
All that talk of the quadruple, but it could all come to an end this Wednesday.
No, it's. I mean, I expected them to be a lot more comfortable than they are. We know that the situation's probably changed a little bit this season because of the lack of fans, but I mean, typically 2-1 at home is not really a win. That leaves you about a 50-50 chance of going through. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. But, I mean, is them having the big players having a rest for this game is quite big. I mean, he really went out of his way to rest them, didn't he? To the extent that he played, I mean, he's so over the overthinking thing that he played Zinchenko in midfield. Played a midfielder in midfield for the first time ever. So he's, I mean, really back to basics. But, no, I think they'll have enough against Dortmund. And I agree with Daniel, actually, looking at the PSG Bayern game, I thought there were a lot of flaws in those two teams, actually. And really, I watched that and thought, this really is City's to lose. This is the season. We've said it. They've probably been the best side in Europe a couple of times under Guardiola already, but I think this is the season where I can't really see why they shouldn't win it this year.
So you see, I mean, you talk about PSG and Bayern both going backwards compared to, say, last season.
Yeah, I mean, particularly Bayern, because Bayern were so good last year, but I don't think they're playing with the same kind of cohesion and compactness. And of course, they're without Lewandowski, who's a player who can change things. And PSG, I think there's some familiar weaknesses there, particularly the forwards not really contributing enough without the ball, which I don't think is an issue for City, in part because they don't really use forwards this season.
Yeah. Bayern, of course, without those players, Gnabry and Lewandowski, and a bunch of others absent this weekend as they got held to a 1-1 draw by Union Berlin. Kingsley Coman also coming off at half-time. So major problems there for Hansi Flick. Paris Saint-Germain, meantime, with a 4-1 win away at Strasbourg, with another goal for Kylian Mbappe and an assist too. Crikey. We'll be previewing all the Champions League action, of course, in Tuesday's Totally Football Show European edition with Alvaro and Rafa and James and Julien. But what about Liverpool-Real Madrid? What are your thoughts on where this stands? The first leg at the iconic Valdebebas training ground. Also, did Zinedine Zidane out-tactic Klopp? And is he due a bit more respect from, you know, football connoisseur Zizou?
Yeah, I think he did in the first game. I thought particularly, yeah, the way they counter-attacked in particular and the way that they switched the play through Toni Kroos, first with diagonal balls and then balls over the top, I thought was really effective. And also on Saturday against Barcelona in the Clásico, I thought Real's system worked really well. He surprisingly dropped Asensio, who scored 4-4, brought in Valverde, played him almost as an extra right-back, which meant Vazquez, who's a right-winger, playing at right-back, almost plays a right-sided centre-back. I think because Real don't have the superstars of yesteryear, Zidane has been forced to be a bit cleverer tactically. And yeah, I think in two games against Liverpool and Barcelona, he's come out of it very well. Probably, I would say if they get through against Liverpool, and I expect them to, I think you could argue it's almost been the best week in management for Zidane, not in terms of, I mean, he's won three European Cups, but in terms of his reputation. Because the European Cups were chalked up as victories for Ronaldo and Bale in the one against Liverpool. But yeah, Zidane tactically, I think, is showing more than probably he ever has as Real manager.
Well, Liverpool did at least get a win at Anfield this weekend against Aston Villa, which is nice, with Real coming to Merseyside on Wednesday. That 2-1 win over the Villains, featuring their first goals from open play at home in 2021. That's extraordinary. Ending a run of six straight defeats at Anfield for Liverpool. It's the first game they played there in 5 weeks. You mentioned what a week it's been for Zinedine Zidane. Quite a big one for Trent as well, who had that wonderful assist against Arsenal, the less wonderful assist for Real Madrid on Tuesday, and then this thumping winner against Aston Villa on Saturday.
Yes, I mean, and that was great for him, but that wasn't Gareth Southgate's point, really. Gareth Southgate's point wasn't that Trent Alexander-Arnold can play in brilliant crosses and can be involved in attacking Liverpool moments. It was the fact that he thinks his defending is slightly slumped, which, given he was at fault for at least one, and I think probably the first Real Madrid goal as well, when he kind of went to kind of almost went with Kabak to try and attack the ball rather than just sweeping up in behind. That doesn't answer those critics. And there's a kind of narrative now that you can see is going to happen, that when Trent Alexander-Arnold does anything good or bad, the reaction will switch to and from Gareth Southgate. In fact, he just needs a few quiet weeks, and he needs Liverpool to stay in the Champions League. Because I think if he plays deep into the Champions League and plays well in there, he'll probably be in the squad. But if Liverpool don't finish top four and go out to Real Madrid, he might not be.
How would you say, after all the controversy over Klopp's lineup for the first game in Madrid, how should he line up Liverpool this Wednesday?
Michael's my go-to man for tactics, obviously. But I was wondering whether Klopp might go for the front four again, which we saw in that Manchester City game, when it was a kind of, he just tried to make it sort of chaos for the first 15 minutes. I suspect they're probably going to have to score early again if they are going to go through. So I wondered if he might go for all four.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there was a bit of speculation that he'd do that for the first game. I think probably the reason he didn't was slightly odd way Real Madrid use a midfield, where Casemiro starts as a holding midfielder and ends up as the number 10, because I don't really know how you stop that with that system. I mean, you can play Firmino as a number 10, but it'll then end up tracking back to in front of his defence, which probably doesn't make sense. But yeah, it's a night where they have to gamble, so maybe you're right. I mean, he's not going to use the same lineup as the first game, is he? I think it's obvious that Thiago will play and set the tempo. And I think Firmino actually was quite a big loss. I know he's not been at his best in recent months, and we know he's not prolific in front of goal, but I thought they really lacked someone to link play. And indeed, I thought he did that quite well for the build-up to the Salah goal at the weekend. I wouldn't be surprised if he went with the same front three, actually. Mane clearly is out of form. I thought we saw at the end Mane went for a shot at goal when he probably should have squared to Jota, I think.
Yeah, it was Jota.
And, I mean, that's just not... Mane's quite selfless, isn't he? He's not Salah. That's the reason he gets annoyed with Salah, because Salah would always go for goal in that situation. Mane usually doesn't, but I think it shows how much Mane is underperforming. He's still getting into the positions, to be fair, but there does seem to be a loss of confidence. So I think maybe he'll be the one to miss out, which you wouldn't have said really at any point over the previous three campaigns.
Just thinking about Liverpool, do they not have more than one that man in their team as well, Adam? Where does the line on that man status? Would Mo Salah not be that man, Mo Salah? And equally, Trent now not in it's that man Trent.
You could argue that man for Trent, but that's for sort of narrative, topical, newsworthy reasons,
right.
Not necessarily goal scoring. Mo Salah does not qualify because, as a already free scoring member of a top six club, it is assumed that he is permanently that man and therefore cannot be elevated to that status. So that man
is somebody who's consistently overperforming or performing outside their roles, kind of perceived expectations.
Well, yeah, in a purple patch as well. And a sudden explosion of form, not necessarily out of nowhere. It doesn't have to be completely unlikely suspect, but kind of big six players generally not that men at all.
Adam, would I be right in saying that a big six forward can be who else but?
I would say so. And then, of course, if it's kind of, you know, script right, script fulfilling goal, like against a former club, then you will definitely only, it had to be, which is a distant cousin of that man.
Salah surely has been temporarily ejected from the who else but category by dint of that 5-game goal scoring drought that he went. But I mean, Lewandowski, for example, or Harry Kane, that's a who else but, surely, no? Or Jesse Lingard right now.
Yeah. I mean, that man tends to precede who else but.
Right.
But who else but is still very much connected. But if you're a consistent performer like Kane, you don't really tend to bother with who else but.
Who knows how many seasons before we're using terms like this with regard to Chelsea players. Chelsea did, though, have a quite a luxurious 4-1 win this weekend. They're also in Champions League action this midweek. Tuesday they're going to be hosting Porto. They're 2-0 up from the first leg, which was in Seville, as will this latest clash between the two sides. The 4-1 game away at Palace, they came out hot from the traps for this one. They wanted it.
There's some important context to this, and I was about to make this point before listener Alex Cooney tweeted in beforehand and said, what is the 2021 COVID equivalent of teams being on the beach? Whatever it is, Palace completely encapsulated it on Saturday. So, yeah, I'm thinking, if you think of all the ingredients for a team being on the beach, Crystal Palace pretty much ticking all the boxes here. 13th place, they're 12 points clear of danger, 12 players out of contract this summer, empty stadiums, you've got the Euros on the horizon for people thinking about it. This could potentially be the most on the beach team in Premier League history. So that's what Chelsea are essentially up against on Saturday.
Are we doing Chelsea a disservice there? Did they make Crystal Palace look like bystanders, or were Palace that complicit in it?
I'm required by UK law to say bit of both.
Right. Nicely done. All right. Well, no Werner, which coincided with Chelsea's best attacking performance under Tuchel. Not sure if we can link those two in any way. But Kai Havertz scoring and assisting. He is very much in a purple patch. And there you go. They take on Porto, as I say, on Tuesday. Not much to be concerned about there.
No, and I think it's probably worth reiterating how quickly Tuchel has made Chelsea probably the second best team in the country since he took over. And I think to an extent, I think they haven't scored many. I think they scored 11 in his first 10 games, but the kind of underlying numbers were always pretty good. I think they've almost created as many chances as Manchester City during his time in charge, which has long been the kind of high watermark. And yeah, they are going to routinely get to a Champions League semi-final, their first since 2014, I think. So it is amazing how quickly he's just kind of clicked them into, oh yeah, this is Chelsea, this is what we do. Which, I think they should be serious title challengers for next season, which is kind of what we'd hope would happen this season under Lampard.
It just constantly amazes me that Chelsea continue to operate while still never quite figuring out what a centre-forward is and how they can find one and then get them to play well for them. They've just got either kicking their heels on the sidelines or just underperforming like Werner. So they've got Abraham, who just doesn't play. Giroud, who just gets called upon in very specialist situations where he's needed. And how a massive club can so consistently fail to nail down a proper number nine and get him to score goals. It's beyond me. No one gets scores over 30 seasons for Chelsea ever. It's baffling for a team who, you know, traditionally create so many chances. It's so weird.
If it's goal-scoring centre-forwards you want, Adam, you can't say fairer than Christian Benteke. Duncan Alexander pointing out this week that 4,347 players have featured in the Premier League, only 52 of them have scored more goals in it than Christian Benteke. So,
give that man a new contract, Crystal Palace.
Absolutely. Right, loads more to come on this Totally Football show, including this.
Keep listening for Alvaro Romeo versus Benji Laniardo in the Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And it's live-ish.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
By the way, if you're keen to hear more from our panel, we've already mentioned Michael's musings on Mourinho's tactics, available at The Athletic, and also a very fine piece he wrote, you know, illustrating or going in depth about how PSG and Bayern aren't what they were. But you can find Adam Hurry with a lovely piece on the return of Fiverside. Adam, really enjoyed that hugely.
Thank you,
this week.
James.
Also on The Athletic. Raises a chuckle in these difficult times. Mm. Daniel with a rather less banter-filled piece on the growing movement to boycott social media over the racist abuse that players have been receiving, which is an ongoing and really dispiriting issue. There have been different thoughts about how much effect they can get. Swansea, for example, have announced a one-week boycott. I read that Birmingham and Rangers in up in Scotland are doing the same. Daniel, you feel that this is something that could have some positive impact?
Well, I mean, it's essentially performative, which everything is when you don't ultimately have the full control, and they don't ultimately have the full control because, you know, the social media platforms are the ones that are going to have to kind of implement the change. But it doesn't work if Birmingham, Swansea and Rangers are the only clubs to do it. It only really works if Manchester City or a Chelsea or a Manchester United or a Liverpool do it, because that will make a difference to things like PR and share price, and it becomes a kind of global news story. With no disrespect to Swansea, the same isn't true of them. But even on their level, it's good that it happens, because so far what's happened is that generally black players or the players who have been racially abused leave social media. At least this feels like a bit more of a community thing where the clubs are supporting those players rather than the kind of the victim having to suspend their account while the kind of horrible storm continues without them.
Adam Crafton writing a piece, though, equally, in which he quotes Sam Allardyce on this issue, saying that he thinks that a boycott would be a good thing, but that the only way it would actually work is if all the clubs decided to do it together. But given the economic times and given that sponsorships are being renewed, etc., they won't ever do that, or they won't do that at the moment because money. So, yeah, difficult. Well, I mean, I think any gesture is something, and it's very, as I say, dispiriting, especially to feel that there's nothing that can be done. But anything that puts pressure on the platforms to tighten up on this kind of thing, I think probably should be welcomed. More Premier League shortly. Adam, though, did you want to talk about, because I see you were tweeting about this week, the good old days of Football Focus. And I don't mean before 8K cameras came out and kind of blurred everything. Football Focus, Dan Walker stepping down as the host after 12 years. Woof.
Blimey.
Yeah.
I tweeted what I thought was some gentle, breezy satire about my traditional consumption of Football Focus since about the age of 8. But it turned into some... I said I was going to become the new presenter of Football Focus, and it turned into this increasingly surreal ego boost. So I'm sorry for misleading several people, including the BBC's Hugh Edwards and Mark Bosnich of the 1990s.
Oh, do they generally get in touch and say congratulations?
Yeah, in an indirect kind of way, yeah, they sort of, yeah. But I mean, I'm glad that people thought that I was a genuine contender, but I don't know who is going to be the new presenter, but good luck to them. Anyway, I've got soccer tots on Saturday morning, so I can't, I'm not.
Oh, available. Okay. Because, yeah. I mean, Football Focus, that's the issue with Football Focus, is that it clashes, particularly now in this age of lunchtime kickoffs. I'm not sure, I'm not really seeing a lot of Football Focus. Daniel, was it a significant programme for you?
It feels, maybe because that's just when I watched it, but it feels like something that, if it wasn't deliberately aimed at kids and teenagers, that was probably, or should be its intended market, because I guess, apart from at the moment, quite a lot of adults are going to games and quite a lot of adults who aren't going to games have other things going on in their lives that they get done at the time football focuses on, so they can watch the football.
I mean, you say at the moment, but actually not at the moment, but usually.
No, but right, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, I used to watch it as a kid, and therefore I think that should probably be the target audience. I'm always afraid of kind of throwing shade at anything that's on terrestrial TV, because I think we kind of forget in the maybe in the little bubble we're in where we do watch football all weekend that masses and masses and literally millions of children don't have access to Sky Sports or BT, and therefore things like Football Focus, they probably come after Sunday morning repeats of Match of the Day, but they might be second to that.
Daniel, what's in Football Focus? I mean, just for people like me or people who are abroad and don't have access to Football Focus, what is it? Does it have Clem in it?
I think it's officially known as a magazine show, which means it will have some previews of games and some highlights of last week, but mainly sort of features.
And a much-loved part of the footballing televisual firmament. Michael, have you got any thoughts on Football Focus?
No, I was on it last year, actually, last
there
season. They came to Kingstonian before a game against Fylde in the FA Cup. And I must say, Dan Walker was really good, actually. Like, you know, really good at, you know, talking to people who weren't usually, you know, weren't accustomed to being on TV.
Oh, did he come down and actually do the thing himself, the filming?
There were two separate bits. I was just at the ground, like, doing a pre-recorded bit saying about the history of the club, but then they were in the clubhouse and stuff. And I don't know, it just felt like it was really good for that kind of... It's got a bit of an FA Cup vibe about it, I think. It's like quite a traditional show. Mm. And yeah, I don't watch every week, but I do appreciate its value. I mean, it's too traditional for Adam to be the presenter. Do you know what I mean? So I immediately didn't buy that joke. Sorry.
Delighted that your first reason for me not presenting Football Focus was not my presenting skills. So that's delighted.
Adam, by the way, before we get back to the Premier League, which everyone's waiting for us to do, a quick word on Power League / Five Aside. You're not the only one of our kind of the, you know, Totally family. So who's any good?
Well, I mean, depending on what your definition of good is, I mean, Tom Williams is incredibly handy if you want someone who's never, ever going to pass you the ball. And I mean, in the nicest possible way, I like him, but he's a genuinely irritating man to play against and with.
Wow. OK, if you were picking a Totally five-a-side team, who would be in it?
Me.
Right.
Alvaro.
Alvaro. Is Alvaro good?
Alvaro's incredible. Everything is done in a blur much quicker than I've ever experienced at five.
Same way he speaks, basically.
Yes, exactly right. Full of knowledge, full of wisdom, and full of expertise, yet done far too quickly for you to be able to deal with. Basically my summary of his football.
I'll tell you who this side would be. Julian's really, really good, right? A classy midfielder, I'd say. Right. Alvaro is great, very skillful, and can kind of bundle his way past challenges very well. Jack Lang is a very good dribbler, quite direct, head up. Rory Smith is a very good player.
And is
the fifth, the fifth, I think, would be Adam, because Adam can do a shift in goal quite well.
Okay, so I was going to ask.
Sasha's the goalkeeper, surely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Sasha's good as well, because he gets... he's big on barking out instructions. And the angrier he gets, the scouser he gets as well, which I really enjoy. There's some good players, but I would echo Adam's thoughts about Tom Williams as well.
Crikey, Tom.
Sorry, Tom.
That's Team Totally available for challenges, you know, for anyone who's listening
should.
And of that mind. Anyway, back onto the Premier League, and this was probably the weekend that the relegation battle was resolved, you were saying, Michael, earlier on, after Newcastle beat Burnley and Fulham lost at home to Wolves. Magpies now 6 points clear of the Cottagers and 11 of West Brom, with a game in hand on both. Does it all now come down to them keeping Sam Maximin fit?
On the evidence of Sunday, yes, absolutely. Sam Maximin and Callum Wilson, basically, who both came on together, and I think the stats are ridiculous. I think Newcastle have something like a 46% win ratio when those two play and 11% when they don't. And someone like Sam Maximin, in some teams, I can imagine he would be quite frustrating, because he does have that kind of old at all. Maybe current Adama Traore tendency of finding a blind alley when there are two open doors. But
he's the sort of Tyneside Tom Williams.
Indeed, yes. Yeah, that's true, with a Gucci headband. But in a team like Newcastle, that's kind of oxygen to them because they are workmanlike if they are a day old. And they need that kind of sprinkling of surprise, which is exactly what happens as soon as he comes on the pitch. He actually works really well, although he's good enough to start. He works really well as a sub because he's completely different to every other Newcastle player.
He came on after 57 minutes in this game with Vidra having put Burnley a goal up after fine link play from Chris Wood. Within 8 minutes, Sam Maximan had made one and scored another and turned the game on its head, providing a vital 3 points for Newcastle.
The thing I really liked about it, about that his goal as well, is that on the replays on TV, which was the one that circled around social media, he does a kind of step over and moves the ball one way, and the cameraman gets done so much that the whole of Sam Maximan goes out of shot until he then takes a shot and scores, which is great.
Brilliant stuff from Sam Maximan, who also has been shining off the pitch. He donated more than 60 care packages to NHS workers on Tyneside this week. What I particularly liked about this was the contents, because he put in luxury confectionery boxes as well as vouchers for high street shops and stuff like that. And there's a note of appreciation from Alan himself. But I think if you get a care package and it doesn't include luxury confectionery boxes, you're probably a little bit disappointed anyway. There you go. Fine work from Dubravka as well, keeping them in it until Sam Maximan could turn up and rescue the Magpies. Fulham, meanwhile, going down 1-0 at home to Wolves on Friday. Fulham players in tears at the end of this. So were plenty of viewers, actually, because it wasn't the greatest game to watch. But it did feature a goal from Adama Traore after 48 games. Crikey. Not since December 2019. Michael, you were mentioning browsing Fulham's run-in fixtures, which, of course, conclude with a clash against Newcastle. There is still time, but this feels like a pretty devastating defeat.
Yeah, it does. They've still got to play Manchester United. They've still got to play Chelsea. Arsenal, not sure whether that's still a tough one. But I feel like this weekend was quite significant. And I must say, probably three matches ago, I would have backed Fulham to stay up ahead of Newcastle. I thought Newcastle were looking in a right state. I mean, it's still live. The good thing, of course, is that the two sides do play each other on the final day of the season at Craven Cottage. The goal difference, I think, is pretty much the same at the moment. So it's 6 points. I mean, if Fulham can get it back to within 3 points, obviously they're going to have a bash at it on the final day, which will be very exciting. I do think probably this weekend was quite damning, especially as Fulham really could have won that game. And obviously Newcastle could have lost theirs.
Yeah. At 6 points, as you say, but they do have a game in hand as well, the Magpies. Having said that, I can't believe I've been rash enough to suggest that anything's done, because this season, perhaps more than any other, has a habit of coming up and biting narrative's bum. Visits to Arsenal and Chelsea next for Fulham. Arsenal, well, you were casting doubt about their status as a tough adversary, Michael, but they looked pretty impressive Sunday night, concluding the first 3 days of this Premier League weekend in a 3-0 win away at Sheffield United. People particularly excited by the opening goal, which had shades of that kind of Giroud-Jack Wilshere affair of yesteryear.
Yeah, not quite on that level, but certainly a lovely passing move between various players between the lines. A kind of classic Arsenal goal, I think we have to call it. But yeah, it was, I mean, it, Sheffield United looked really poor, actually. Not just technically, but clearly lacking confidence. I mean, some of the mistakes, John Lundstrom's misplaced pass for the second goal, the Martinelli goal. Just don't know what he was doing there. But yeah, it was a good game for Arsenal to just get some confidence with a few players. Martinelli, his first goal for over a year. Thought Ceballos looked as good as he's looked for a while, with a lot of clever back flicks. Thomas Partey, didn't think he had a great game, but got a really good assist for Lacazette. It was interesting what they did at left back. Played Xhaka there. Obviously, they're without a proper left back, without Tierney. Cedric is the obvious option. Saka seemed like the second choice option. But they went for Xhaka, probably because they knew against Sheffield United they'd be a bit physical and maybe wanted the physical presence across the back four. Because they had Chambers at right back as well. So it's quite a big back four. But yeah, it was routine for Arsenal, really.
Right. Some worrying news, though, ahead of Thursday's delicately poised Europa League second leg with Slavia Prague being Bukayo Saka's exit from the game. Not sure the entity of that injury.
He was feeling his groin, which is a bit of a worry. I mean, I'm always slightly reluctant to say this kind of thing because, you know, the clubs have the medical data on the players, but I'm slightly worried about Saka and exhaustion over the last couple of months. I think his form isn't quite as good as at the start of the season. And I think when it's pretty much his first full Premier League campaign, especially with such a busy one, I do think sometimes players run out of steam and, yeah, hopefully it's not a serious injury.
How optimistic is everyone for Thursday night and Slavia Prague against Arsenal?
I think Slavia are actually a really good team. They didn't show it in the first leg, but I was really, really impressed with them against Leicester and against Rangers. And I think Arsenal are up against it. I think maybe there's an argument that Arsenal get a couple of away goals. And yeah, I think the situation with away goals is slightly weird this season, isn't it? I think Arsenal are just about favourites, but I think Slavia will be a lot better than they were on Thursday, where they didn't really turn up going forward, but they've got a couple of really quite exciting players on the. I mean, players who I think could play in top six clubs in the Premier League. I think they shouldn't be underestimated. So, yeah, a difficult game.
Well, they've already furnished one top six side with a couple of gems in Sofal and Socek. All right, well, big game that for Arteta, who, as you probably heard mention, has now reached the same number of games that Unai Emery had in charge of the Gunners, but with 10 points less for Mikel, which is not the most convincing of stats from his point of view. But anyway, there you go. We'll be talking much more about Thursday's Europa League fixtures and all that in Tuesday's European Totally Football Show. Still to come from the Premier League on Monday evening, as mentioned earlier, West Brom against Southampton and Brighton Everton. A quick mention that you can sign up for a subscription with The Athletic for unrivaled coverage on the business end of the season. All the articles, all the podcasts ad-free and Q&As with writers. All that for just £4 a month. Head to theathletic.com/totally. But now, and speaking of Q&As with writers, it's time for the climax of today's show. The latest battle in the Intertotally Cup.
The Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. Stadiums might not yet be full, but Paddy's offers are at full capacity. Get a free bet if one leg of your 4-plus fold acca lets you down on all football matches and markets. T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
Yes, Intertotally time. Coxie, Matt Davis Adams, Duncan, Sasha and Filthy Jack Lang are all through to the quarterfinals. Let's meet the two fresh contestants looking to join them.
Up first, he's a commentator and one of last year's semi-finalists. All the way from Peckham, he is Totally's Basque Lion. He is Alvaro Romeo.
Rocking the fresh young sounds of the Alan Parsons Project, it is Alvaro Romeo. Alvaro, your run to the semis last year was the stuff of dreams. How are you feeling this year?
I'm feeling very well. I was a little bit relieved that Daniel Story was out because I didn't want to suffer back-to-back defeats against the same opponent for 2 years. But I was scared with the level of Sasha Goriuno. So let's see what happens. I think that Benji can be a hell of a competitor, but I'm going to keep the discipline of a samurai and go round by round and don't think about the future.
That's an excellent policy. Competition's so very fierce this year. The quality of anything has only increased. As you know, another thing that's improved this year is the fact that we're going to be donating, or Paddy Power will be donating £10 to the winner's charity of choice and then placing that £10 on the bet of their choosing, with the winnings also going to charity. Alvaro, what will your charity of choice be?
My charity will be Shelter. They basically donate and help for people who are facing homelessness.
Brilliant. What's your bet going to be, Alvaro?
My bet will be on Barcelona to beat Atletico in 4 weeks.
All right, excellent stuff. Let's now meet your opponent. Let me see those hands again.
Everybody jump. And his opponent, sticking two fingers up to UEFA by observing only the Uncle Jeff coefficient, residing in Finsbury Park but representing the East End of London and all hammers everywhere, it is Benji Laniardo.
Strikes striking an early blow in the intro music battle there. Benji Laniardo, welcome to the Intertotally Cup.
Hey, Jimbo. Yeah, I'm very excited to be here.
Great. All right. Well, obviously, it's been an amazing season for the Hammers. And like them, you're aiming top four at least, yes?
Absolutely. And I'm a privilege to be up against a European giant in Alvaro. And yeah, I'm just hoping for, you know, a fun day out for all the fans.
Great.
So, very excited.
Is Uncle Jeff there rooting for you?
He's always there. We did a 4-hour football trivia session this morning just to sort of get limber. So yeah, good to go.
Only four. Okay. What's your charity of choice?
The Whittington Hospital.
Which is?
It's a hospital in Archway that over the last year has been pretty extraordinary to the local community and my family too.
Brilliant. What's your bet going to be, Benj?
I always like long shots. So let's go for Arsenal to qualify for European competition this season.
Crikey. All right then. Let's get our questions on now though. Alvaro, you're up first.
Let's go.
Okay. Alvaro, question one. Which was Jose Mourinho's first club as a head coach stroke manager? Have we lost Alvaro on the line? It's gone very quiet.
Jose Mourinho was the manager of...
Which club, first of all? What was the first club on his managerial
this
CV?
This is bad. Rio Ave?
No. A lot of people would have said, is it Union Leira? But actually Benfica for a brief and not very successful stint. Question two. Which Brazilian club did Clarence Seedorf briefly play for?
Was it Flamengo?
It was not. Not far away. Botafogo.
Botafogo.
Yes. Yes, Benji. Question three. The son of which former European great, who played for both Barcelona and Real Madrid, was part of Rangers' Scottish Premiership winning team this season?
Can you say the question again?
Of course. The son of which former European great, who'd played for both Barcelona and Real Madrid, was part of Rangers' Scottish Premiership winning team this season. So whose son played for Rangers? The dad used to play for Barcelona and Real Madrid and was a bit of a ledge.
I'm a bit lost with this one.
Son of a famous footballing dad in the Rangers team this year, Alvaro.
I don't know. That's my answer.
Benji.
Is it Hadji?
It is George Hadji.
Oh,
sorry, it's
yes.
Yanis Hadji, son of George. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary. Okay. Question four, Alvaro. You need this.
Yeah.
Which player who would go on to play in England scored the Czech Republic's goal in the Euro 96 final against Germany?
Patrick Berger.
Is correct.
Fortunately.
Question five. Who scored both goals for Atletico Madrid against Fulham in the 2010 Europa League final?
Diego Forlan.
Exactly. All right. So 2 points out of five. Alvaro, any thoughts?
I think the questions were fantastic, and I feel a little bit angry with myself for not having guessed the Yanis Hadji one. Mm. But anyway, I'm hoping for the best. Hopefully Benji won't have his best day today.
Yeah, all right. Let's see. Benji, you're up next. Here they go. Question one. Which manager did Jose Mourinho take over from at Real Madrid?
Bit of a guess, but was it Pellegrini?
It was Pellegrini, Benji.
Ooh.
Inspired stuff. Question two. Which Argentinian club did Daniele De Rossi briefly play for?
I think that's Boca, isn't it?
It is Boca, and you're now level with Alvaro's score. Crikey, three questions to go. But the difficulty ramps up now as I ask you question three. Which club currently has the sons of Dennis Bergkamp, Dennis Wise, and Mauricio Pochettino on their books?
Is it Spurs?
It is not. It's Watford.
Watford.
Remarkable, isn't it? Dennis Bergkamp, Dennis Wise, and Mauricio Pochettino's offspring. Question four. Which player, who would go on to play in England, scored Denmark's opener in the Euro 92 final against Germany?
The final?
Yes. Denmark's opener in the final against Germany.
John Jensen.
It was John Jensen, Benji. And you've just won yourself a place in the quarterfinals. Woohoo!
Massive.
There is another question to go. Would you like to hear it?
Yeah, sure.
Who scored the winner for Chelsea in the 2013 Europa League final?
That's a great question. Europa League final, 2013 Chelsea.
Yeah. Alvaro, you got the smile of a man who knows the answer to this.
Well, he's a Spanish guy, I think, but... No, okay. I'm smiling for him. I mean, I'm angry at myself. Believe right. me, there is no sign of happiness in me right now.
Oh,
I'll take Alvaro's alley-oop and guess Fernando Torres.
No, it's not Fernando Torres.
Mata?
Branislav Ivanovic. Branislav Ivanovic. How come we don't remember that? You got it though, didn't you, listener? Clever you. Anyway, well, listen. So 3 out of 5, narrowly pipping Alvaro's 2 out of 5. To a place in the quarterfinals in, as I say, this extremely high quality edition of the Intertotally Cup. Your thoughts, Benji?
Oh, dreamland, absolute dreamland. You know, this is. I'm on cloud nine. I'm just going to take each game as it comes,
right,
and enjoy it. You know.
Well, next up for you, it's Jack Lang in the quarterfinals, so that is going to be stonking.
Bring it, smart boy.
All right then. Alvaro, thank you so much for joining us. Quick word on what you think is going to happen when Liverpool take on Real Madrid.
I think Real Madrid will go through. They were very good against Barcelona again, and I expect them, even, I would tell you, beating Liverpool at Anfield.
Right, 3-2 with you and Benji today. Same scoreline for Real, do you think?
Will that work for Real Madrid? Yes. So I'm sure that they will be taking that.
Right. Okay. Excellent. Well, listen, we'll be speaking to you anyway and previewing that and all the rest of the midweek action in Tuesday's Totally Football Show. But many thanks to both you and Benji for joining us today, and we'll have more into Totally on Thursday. Bittersweet experience for our panel listening to that, because Michael, you're through as reigning champion to the quarterfinal. Daniel, you got knocked out by Sasha Gurionov in a shock first round defeat. And Adam, you quite simply weren't invited.
Didn't qualify, maybe, is the...
Didn't qualify, right. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Well, anyway, there you go. Fabulous having you with us, though, on Totally today, Adam. And many thanks. Any other thoughts before we let everyone get on with their weeks? Nope. That's it. We've covered the football. Brilliant. On Tuesday, Totally returns with the Euro gang to talk the midweek fixtures and all the craziness that's happened over the weekend, so do join us for that. For now, from all of us here, it's many, many thanks and have a lovely week.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Brought to your ears by The Athletic, I'm Adam Hurry, and Football Clichés is the podcast you never knew you needed. Every week, to quite unnecessary depth, we examine the words, the phrases, the accepted wisdom, the mannerisms, the habits, the gestures, the symbols, the sounds, and the smells that everyone takes for granted in football, but which really are the glorious glue that holds it all together. For example, have you ever really listened to the Football League goals roundups? I mean, really listened to them? Because they all sound pretty much like this.
Team X went into this game with just one win in their last 13, and when Team Y took the lead inside 4 minutes at Stadium Z, the home fans were probably starting to fear the worst. But striker A had other ideas, and this game turned on its head in the space of 5 minutes midway through the second half. First, a smart finish from the edge of the box brought Team X level, and he repeated the trick on the hour mark to bring his tally for the season to 22. By now, Team X were in the mood, and although striker A squandered a gilt-edged chance to complete his hat-trick, on-loan Dutchman winger B made it 3 with a curling effort from long range. Team Y's misery was compounded in stoppage time when midfielder C's late challenge on fullback D saw them reduced to 10 men. An afternoon to forget for manager E's men then, but Team X will hope they have finally turned a corner under caretaker boss manager F.
Listen to Football Clichés wherever you get your podcasts, and also ad-free when you subscribe to The Athletic.
The Athletic.